17. I'm going to record, if that's okay, just for my own edification. I really really want to thank you guys for coming to learn. I've got one left. I want to start out by saying two things. First of all, thank you so much. We're going to try and use the slides behind me to show you. I have some images and timelines that we're going to hopefully go over. And I'm also going to try not to trip over these wires over here. So we'll see if I'm successful with that. We have about 40 minutes, Inyan, and maybe even less. I want to leave some time for questions to talk about this topic, which is something I think about a lot as a religious Zionist, and frankly, for anybody that's interested in religious Zionism, it's a very important topic to discuss. It's akshavi, as we would say in modern Hebrew. It's timely. It's contemporary. And my goal, I always just a statement of goals. I've run out of the sheets of slides, so now we're gonna have to rely on this. So if you want to be generous and share with each other, it's also good. The more you understand about Israel, the deeper your Zionism is, the more you understand about the underpinnings of different zramim, different streams in Israel nowadays, I think that it adds a wrinkle, or many wrinkles. It adds depth to our Zionism, to our love of the land of Israel, and that the goal tonight is to learn about one of the most important streams of Zionism, religious Zionism in particular, and to talk about it through the prism of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. I'm going to say Sklusu Yagen Aleinu. I always say that when I say his name, may his merit protect us and all the Jewish people, as filtered through two of his chief students. I would say his two most important students, and we'll learn about them in a second. But before that, just to preface for a moment, I was hesitant. I was talking to Bob about this. I was hesitant to even discuss this topic, especially with the times in Israel that we're living through right now. There was something that might to discuss an ideological split, a machloket, a dispute, and to talk about the finer points that maybe have a little bit of an academic remove felt inappropriate, especially when the entire country and really the entire Jewish world writ large is a time of coming together. I wanted to focus more on something that was in relation, maybe talking about what is the religious Zionist approach now to tragedies, that ongoing tragedy that began with the Simchat Torah massacres. Just parenthetically, something that I've seen on Israeli channels or in Hebrew, in the Reshet, as they say, is that people are calling this, you know, like October 7th. In Israel, or in modern Jewish history, we call it the Yom Kippur War, right? We combine the war, the tragedy of that war, and the eventual triumph, but we combine that with the very hallowed, sacred day that it occurred on. I think also it's apropos to say the Simchat Torah massacre, tragedy of Simchat Torah, that it happened on a day. Not to elide the point, this happened on a holy day, a day when we were supposed to be in joy, a day that we were supposed to be focused on spiritual pursuits. And of course, that focus and that time of drawing down was something that was exploited by our enemies in the most cruel, callous, and vicious of ways. So Bob said, our theme, we're going to stick with our theme. He said that it would really be good. People want to hear about the topic that you're talking about. It would be really good to focus on the topic. So we're going to go along with it, but I want to at least acknowledge where this is coming from, and I'll start with the story. The story is like this. I'm in Israel. It's my first year learning yeshiva, a gap year program, very typical high school, modern Orthodox high school kid. You learn for a year after Israel, and the first year in Israel, maybe your kids have told you this if you sent them for a gap year, the first year is not really about spending a lot of time in the yeshiva or the seminary or the program. It's about going out as much as possible. It's an advanced tourism degree. And we tried to spend the entire year auguring for ourselves all kinds of different experiences, meeting all kinds of new people. And I certainly had many of these experiences. I had one experience. My father had somehow gotten me in touch with a man named Elyon Shemesh. Now, Elyon Shemesh, he had long hair. I haven't spoken to him or seen him in many, many years. I know that he did shlichut. He was an emissary out in Montreal, actually. Talk about another place going through a tough time right now if you're a Jew. But Elyon Shemesh, my father got me in touch with him, guitar playing, as a musician, all that stuff that you would imagine. You know, I think I met him first, he was wearing like a tunic, I think. And he invited me to spend a Shabbos in his house. Later on I found out he doesn't really have a house, he has a caravan. And that he doesn't really live in a community, but he lives on a hilltop. And I, as 17, 18, I think at the time, was like, yes, let's go. And is it dangerous? It's dangerous. Awesome, let's go. Should we tell our parents about it? No, of course not. Are we going to take buses? Absolutely. and everything our parents said, don't do. We go out to his house. If you're familiar with the road outside of Yerushalayim, so if you take Kfish Shishim, which is called an army, I hope I'm not giving it a military secret, it's called Sir Brazil. That's the main road that goes through north of Yerushalayim into what we call Hevel Binyamin, which is the Binyamin area of settlements, and then above that is the Shomron proper. And you take, that's the main road. It goes all the way. If you take that road all the way up, you'll end up in Khawara, which you've heard in the news. Khawara is a very dangerous part of the road because it goes directly through an Arab village. There's been a number of terror attacks there. There's been some reprisals, unfortunately, that have happened in that area as well. The army just opened up a Kfish Okef, a surrounding road that goes behind it that is protected. And that's Kfish Shishim. So Kfish Shishim goes, and as you get out of Yerushalayim, you pass Ramallah over here, you start to go up, and then you have a strip of Yishuvim, of settlements there. And one of the settlements is called Ma'alei Michmash. Anybody ever here, ever been there?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ma'alei, very, very beautiful. And the other side of the road of Ma'alei Michmash is Mitzvah Dani. Mitzvah Dani was founded by people who were living in Ma'alei Michmash, who moved over to the other side of the road after Dani, the... Am I getting this?
Danny Frank,
yeah. He was murdered, and they decided that the way they were going to respond to his murder was by building. And they moved a bunch of caravans, bilti chuki, against Israeli law. I think now the Ma'achaz has a quasi-legal status, and it's on this hill. It's on this hill that overlooks what we, like Kikar HaYarden, right? I was just learning today in Sefer Melachim, in the Book of Kings, when King Solomon wanted to forge the brass for the first temple, he did it in Kikar HaYarden. So you can look at these verses, and you could see these places. And it looks out there, the sun sets there. The sun goes down, and we got a little bit of this in Stanford. The sky turns into bubblegum, cotton candy, purples and pinks and blues. And the wind starts to come in over the plain and comes up onto Mitzvah Dani. And you stand on these cliffs, and you're looking at Bible land. You're looking at Bible land. You're seeing verses in front of you. And the feeling is one, even as an 18-year-old standing there, not knowing really much about, like, Torah at that point at all. I still don't. But not knowing much about anything. And you stand there, and the Jewish heart is intoxicated. It is a completely intoxicating feeling. It has this almost narcotic effect to you, because you're standing there, beholding this sight, and thinking, this is mine. And this is our land. And look at where my feet are standing. And that's the feeling of the people that live there under not such ideal circumstances. And part of it was always in the back of my mind when we would go there and to other places, what would drive people to be out in this place? Not much running water, not much electricity, the threat of sometimes being moved away by Tzahal, evicted by Tzahal, according to the laws and the rules of the Israeli government. What would motivate people to be here? And another scene that I'm going to paint for you is many years later. I had served in the army, I had gotten married, and I met my wife. My wife has a cousin and a friend who grew up in America, and she married an Israeli, and they live in Katamon, another wonderful place. And he said, why don't you come out with me? The wives will hang out, they'll do their thing. Come out with me, I want to take you to see something special. And you'll understand, hopefully, by the end of this year where these two stories come together. And he takes me out to another yeshuv. The name of this yeshuv, the name of this settlement is called Tekoa. And we get in our car, and I don't really know exactly where I'm going, and we pass by where the actual yeshuv is, where the actual settlement is, which has houses arranged, and we make our way to a caravan, again, at the edge of the settlement. And inside, I'm in a room with all different kinds of people. Now it's not the long peyote, they're called guzambot in Israel, the long peyote and the huge knitted kippot and women in mitpachot, and it's not that. Instead, it's a scene, it's a tapestry, if you will, of all different kinds of people. Religious, secular, all chassidim, right? There's all kinds of different people. There are charedim are there, and everybody is waiting for the rabbi of Tekoa to show up. The name of the rabbi of Tekoa, who we'll meet later on, is Rabbi Menachem Froman. Rabbi Menachem Froman, who, if you've ever heard the name of Menachem Froman, was the founder of Tnuat Eretz Shalom, the movement for the land of peace. Rabbi Menachem Froman had the distinction, he passed away a few years ago, he had the distinction of being the first and only rabbi, as far as I'm concerned, to ever meet with Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the founder of Hamas. And Rabbi Menachem, who was a settler, Rabbi Menachem, who was a student of a student of Rav Kook. Rabbi Menachem was somebody that believed deeply that the land itself transcends political boundaries, and he is famous for saying that I am willing to live as a Jewish citizen of a Palestinian state. It's only about the land. I just want to be connected to some famous pictures of him standing on the same kind of promontory overlooking the Yehuda and Shomron, those terraced mountains and with those craggy peaks, with his talus out and sheep behind him and his peyote flying, these long white peyote and a white kippah on top of his head. And I think that that was exemplifying. There's supposed to be at a night where he was going to be playing with leftist Israeli rock stars who followed Rabbi Menachem. And they would play, it was called Derve Shira Torah, and they would play music, and all kinds of people, settlers, non-settlers. Rabbi Menachem, even though he was so fake, he absorbed a lot of criticism, terrible criticism. His home was hit with rocks by people in the very yeshuv that he was the leader of. Rabbi Menachem believed deeply in this, and they would have these nights of song and dance. You can see them on YouTube. It's also an intoxicating experience to even watch, with Ehud Banai, who was already religious this time, a major Israeli rock star, playing music, and all these people are crowded into this trailer and learning Zohar afterwards. And in my mind, that's almost another picture of what kind of people get driven to do such a thing in a caravan at the edge of the yeshuv, also under considerable danger, but in a very different way, in a very different manifestation. What is the motivator? What is the animating factor of these people's ideology? So I'm going to step over here. I was supposed to bring my... somebody saw me do a presentation at Bicultural, and my clicker wasn't working. And they said, I got to get you a clicker. And of course, I forgot it for this. So enter Rav Kook. This is Rav Kook over here. I'm going to stand on the side because we have these slides. I'm just going to read you a poem. And this poem, I think, captures... It's the name of the poem in Hebrew is called Merchavim, Wide Open Expanses. It goes like this. In the first Hebrew, when you say merchavim, merchavim, merchavim av tanafshi, expanses, 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 my expanses divine my soul craves. Confine me not in cages of substance or spirit. My soul soars the expanses of the heavens. Walls of heart and walls of deed will not contain it. Morality, logic, custom, my soul soars above these, above all that bears a name, above delight, above every delight and beauty, above all that is exalted and ethereal. I am lovesick. I thirst for God. When we talk about Rav Kook being a mystic, this is what we mean. Rav Kook writes many, many poems. Rav Kook actually has a number of poems during his sojourn when he got stuck in Europe after the outbreak of the First World War, where Rav Kook enters into an almost, sometimes we have like Goya has, during the Spanish Civil War, the painter Goya has like the black paintings, the dark paintings, that Saturn eating his son. So Rav Kook enters that period also, and he's these poems of kniha, of deep, deep desire, of deep, deep pining to be back in the land of Israel. He's born in Griva, Latvia, something of a mixed marriage. His mother comes from Lubavitch Hasidim, really Kapust Hasidim, which is an offshoot of Lubavitch Hasidut. And his father is a Lithuanian, what we would call an anti-Hasidic family. The story is that Rav Kook's mother took a piece of the top coat of one of the Lubavitch rebbes, the Tzemach Tzedek, the third of the rabbis of Lubavitch, and sewed a piece of his top coat into Rav Kook's kippah when Rav Kook was a child. I guess it worked, because whatever she had in mind for my son to become a great leader of Israel, Rav Kook certainly was. Rav Kook, at a very young age, entered the Volozhin Yeshiva, just to give you a sense of what that means. The Volozhin Yeshiva, apparently the entry test, my culture is not like this, but apparently the entry test was you needed to be tested on 200 pages of the Babylonian Talmud, which means that you needed to know them. They could ask you two questions, and you needed to be familiar and know these questions to get in. It was the highest. Probably the most hallowed halls of Torah learning. Rav Kook is there, as you can see, at a very young age, and comes extremely close with the sainted head of the yeshiva, also known as the Nitziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, author of a timeless commentary on the Torah, Responsa. Rav Kook ends up learning with him. I'll tell you one quick, amazing story about Rav Kook, maybe to drive in what we mean when we talk about the mystic, the kind of individual. Rav Kook was known already at an early time. He was known for being beyond expanses. Nothing could contain Rav Kook. Nothing could contain the spirit. So this genius, this Eloi, this prodigy of Talmud and traditional study was already, there was, say, Miran and Imachra. People were whispering about him. He's into interesting things. Perhaps they could have sensed the beginnings of Zionism happening in Rav Kook's soul. Whatever it was, is that they were, there was word in the yeshiva that Rav Kook was hiding newspapers. I'll come over here to demonstrate for you. So here's Rav Kook's shtender in Balaj and Yeshiva, and everybody's learning, and Rav Kook would stand all day. He would learn for about 18 hours a day. He would stand all day, and they saw that Rav Kook would open up the drawer underneath the shtender. He said, ah, he has newspapers on. He's reading the Yiddish newspapers under there. That's what they thought Rav Kook was doing. So the story actually comes from Rav Zelig Reuven Bengis, who later on became the head of the Eda Charedit, which is the ultra-Orthodox, I don't like that term, but for lack of a better term, the ultra-Orthodox faction, very anti-Zionist as well, that resides in Yerushalayim, you may see them sometimes in sackcloth and ashes on Yom HaAtzmaut. And they decided, they were younger at the time, they're going to go find, they're going to look in Rav Kook's drawers. They have to wait a while to see if Rav Kook went on. They open up the drawer, and inside they find, maybe you've seen this, it's a Shiviti. You know what Shiviti is? Shiviti comes from the word Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. I will place God before me always. It's a menorah, and the menorah is written by a scribe in a special way that has one of the Psalms of Tehillim. So every branch of the menorah, and has a huge tetragrammaton, Yud Ke Vav Ke. That Rav Kook, instead of reading a newspaper as they expected, instead of having a contraband, he had the absolute. He was learning at the same time. He was focusing his learning, always being conscious and focusing himself on God at that time. That's Rav Kook. Rav Kook is in Balazs, and he marries Batsheva, the daughter of the rabbi of Panovich. You may have heard Panovich is the highest yeshiva of learning, one of the highest yeshivas of learning in Israel. The name of his father is Rav Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Ta'omim. He's a twin. The word Ta'omim is twin. He is the rabbi of Panovich, later on becomes appointed rabbi, together with Rav Shmuel Salant, chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Position Rav Kook will fill later. In 1887, Rav Kook becomes the rabbi of Zoimel. His first writings are from this time. And already in Zoimel, Rav Kook starts to get involved in literary efforts, starts to write in Yiddish, even starts a small and short-lived literary journal with rabbinic writings in it. He marries, his wife passes away after 2 years, unfortunately. That's one of the first, but not the only tragedy Rav Kook would see in his life. He marries Raisa Rivka after the death of Batsheva, and then in 1891, their first and only son is born, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who we're going to come to in a moment. Rav Tzvi Yehuda is born in 1895, Rav Kook arrives in Boisk. We have the first Rav Kook's journals. I had his journal, the Shabbos I was reading. He has his diaries, uncensored, unfiltered diaries where Rav Kook writes about everything from Spinoza to Shabtai Tzvi to Kabbalah to the Aleph Beis to the mystical significance of the letters. It's all there, and his poetry. And then while he's the rabbi in Boisk, Rav Kook is appointed as the rabbi and arrives in Jaffa in Mandatory Palestine. Cook receives an invitation, he goes directly there, which is no small thing. It's not, Aliyah nowadays is hard. Rav Kook goes directly there. In fact, on Rav Kook's gravestone, which I've been to, on Mount of Olives and Har HaZeitim Yerushalayim, so it says three things underneath: Rav Kook, Rabba Shel Yerushalayim, Rabbi of Jerusalem, Allah Arza, ascends to Israel, and it gives the date, 1905 in Hebrew, ascends to Jerusalem, arrives in Jerusalem. Where is it? Arrives in Jerusalem in 1919, and then the date of his death, Gimel Elul, arrives in Shamayim, Allah Shamayim. Three aliyot, three ascents that mark all of Rav Kook's life. Rav Kook goes in 1913 on the Masah HaMoshavot. Already Rav Kook has begun to become completely enmeshed with the ferment of modern Hebraic society that was happening in Israel at the time. He meets with the literary and scholarly elite at the time. Yosef Brenner, and Bialik comes to Rav Kook's house. Mark Chagall even meets Rav Kook when he comes to Israel at the time. And Rav Kook is seen as this rabbi, and you can see his, I don't know if I could pronounce this word right, the visage, did I get that right? Let's say, be nice, right? The picture of Kook with peyote, this happens to be one of him without a hat. This is an approximation. We have this picture hanging in my house, in my study, and Rav Kook looks nothing like them. The tan, sandal-wearing, new Hebrew. Rav Kook is seen as somebody, some regard him as a bit of a curio, some take him more seriously than others, but he's seen as something quite different. In 1913, he goes around to the Masah HaMoshavot. He goes around to all of these new agricultural settlements to strengthen them. He walks around, they'll save a few stories because I'm going to run out of time. If you know me, this happens a lot. And then Rav Kook gets stuck. He gets stuck in, he goes to raise money. He goes to the Knesia. It was a gathering of rabbis from across Europe. Rav Kook goes as a representative of the land of Israel. And he gets stuck, first in Switzerland, then in London. We know exactly where Rav Kook lived in London. He becomes a rabbi, a pulpit rabbi in London for 2 years, the Machzike Adas Synagogue in London, and finally he comes back to Jerusalem, he's appointed chief rabbi, he absorbs a tremendous amount of opprobrium and controversy, because they say, here's a rabbi that writes about the sanctity of soccer-playing, Sabbath-violating youths in Jerusalem, which is, of course, passage number 32 in Rav Kook's magnum opus, Orot. Passage 32 talks about Hayitalmut, the exercise that the youth of Israel do. And other rabbis who look like Rav Kook, who come from the same yeshivas as Rav Kook, look at him and say, what are you doing? What are you talking about? They're Sabbath violators. They're violating everything that we know to be sacred, and you are sanctifying it. And Rav Kook says, I absolutely am. Rav Kook is spit on. Rav Kook is excoriated. There are charamim, excommunications, and bans placed upon him. Rav Kook is not moved at all. Rav Kook sees, and this is essential philosophical linchpin of Cook's religious Zionism, Rav Kook sees that the flowering of our redemption as a Jewish people and the building of a state and the building of a state that will eventually serve as kisei, as a seat for Mashiach, for the Messiah, and there's a deep messianism that runs throughout all this, that can happen even through people who are not going to pay fealty to tradition and to the Torah in the ways that it's been done for centuries amongst the Jewish people. There's sanctity in what they're doing, there's holiness in what they're doing, and Rav Kook for this basically stands alone. There are other religious Zionist rabbis. There are rabbis that come before Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rav Yehuda Leib Alkalai, who come a century before Rav Kook. You have people that espouse a kind of religious Zionism, but it's religious Zionism is much more pragmatic and different. I'll just give you an example of what that means. Rabbi Reines, who was the head of the Mizrahi, was a tremendous Talmid Chacham. The Mizrahi at the Fifth Zionist Congress, the Mizrahi supported the Uganda plan. They said much more than anything else, even if it's not going to be in Israel, take us to Uganda, wherever it is, so that Jews can be safe. We could see, and I don't know if this might sound familiar, but in the liberal cognoscenti, in the newspapers, this is what Herzl, who was in those circles, that they did not stand up. When Dreyfus was defrocked, they did not stand up. The people that we thought were enlightened, that were supposed to know better, right? That they did not stand up. They said, oh, we got a problem here. Something is rotten underneath the surface. And it only takes a little thing to bring that out. There was a much more pragmatic group. Cook's Zionism was something that was rooted in a deep mysticism, in a sense that the redemption of the Jewish people is going to be the redemption of the entire world. And it's going to happen here in this holy land. Rav Kook establishes the chief rabbinate, he establishes his dream of the worldwide universal yeshiva, Merkaz Harav, and then in 1935, Rav Kook passes away. That is the figure of Kook, the significance, the magnitude of this individual for religious Zionists in the land of Israel cannot be overstated. I've been to multiple houses when I was in yeshiva, and in families, it happened more than once. Families on every Friday night would take out a little portion of Rav Kook's diaries and they would read it before their Friday night meals. His picture, much as it adorns my own house, his picture adorns the homes of many people. The Merkaz Harav Yeshiva is still one of the highest and most revered institutions of religious Zionist learning, although it itself has gone through many changes throughout the years. And this is the legacy of Rav Kook. In fact, when you refer to Rav Kook amongst these circles, he's not Rav Kook, it's Maran HaRav Kook. It's our master, the teacher, Rav Kook. Much like people might refer in modern Orthodox world to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik as the Rav, simply. And you know he's talking about Lahavdil when people say, won't talk about like Michael Jackson or Michael Jordan, but you get the idea. The people that are known by the mononym that you get, you know exactly who we're talking about. Rav Kook has a number of students, right? And we're going to skip these two sentences. You could read it inside. I already gave you a sense of Kook in the Ma'amar Ador, which is a letter. Not a letter. It's an essay that he wrote. It's published in a collection of essays that Rav Kook dedicated to his father-in-law called Eder Hayakar, Aleph Dalet Reish, for Aderet, Eliyahu David Rabinowitz. So Rav Kook writes about, talking about my generation, when people saw wickedness, Sabbath violations, throwing off, casting off the yoke of observance, Rav Kook saw holiness. Rav Kook saw Jews doing amazing things, the swamp drainers, I like to call them, who are dedicating their lives and putting themselves in risk to build the land of Israel. He says this generation is light and darkness mixed in together, and the old school, the school that Rav Kook represents, must get wise to this. They must join hands with them. Rav Kook also, his Zionism is complex. He even started a short-lived party and said, we shouldn't call ourselves, we say, Eretz Tzion Yerushalayim. So Rav Kook says, I'm not a Zionist, I'm a Jerusalemist. And Rav Kook started a short-lived political party that was called Degel Yerushalayim, that was the Jerusalem flag, which was he wrote this letter in response to the Mizrahi delegation saying, oh, we'll take Uganda. We're okay with that. Rav Kook says, no, nothing of the sort. So here's Rav Kook writing over here, and you could see that young man standing above Rav Kook. I feel like I'm doing calisthenics over here. This young man, this is Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, his one and only son. That's Rav Kook writing. Rav Tzvi Yehuda says that his father would become so entranced during his writing that he would write directly onto the table. It was like automatic writing. Rav Kook would be also in a state of intoxication, I guess. This is Rav Tzvi Yehuda in his later years. And let's learn a little bit about Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, I think, represents one zera, one approach of what Rav Kook's teachings, especially about Zionism, what they mean. And we're going to look at two images. Here's Rav Tzvi Yehuda talking. Underneath, you can see a picture of his father. And this is at a dedication of the new building that is in, I'm going to get the neighborhood wrong, right by the Tachan Amerkazit. You might see, you know, the Gesher HaMeitarim, the David's Kinor David Bridge. You know, when you come into Jerusalem, you come up that hill, that amazing feeling, you come off the airport, then hopefully the Nesher will take you where you need to go. You guys know what I'm talking about? If you don't, that's really good. Maybe you've got better transportation from the airport. So when you come up there, it's in the something Moshe neighborhood. I'm forgetting the name of it now.
Kiryat Moshe.
Thank you. A lot of happier here. Right? So this is the dedication center. It's Yehuda speaking. I think Zerachor Haftig, the head of the NRG at the time, Chaim Shapira, another major politician. They're all there. You see unbearded fellows. And then this is, anybody familiar with this picture? You guys ever seen this picture? This is Hanan Porat. I don't remember who it is in the other side. Hanan Porat, Rabbi Hanan Porat, who was a student of Tzvi Yehuda. And this is a picture in Sebastia. Sebastia eventually became, not quite in Sebastia, but right next to it became the first major yeshuv. I want to say Shiloh. I think it was Shiloh. Was built right next to it. Shiloh or Itamar, I can't remember exactly which one. This is after the Six-Day War. This picture is ecstasy. If you're looking to describe the feelings of going out into the hills and settling them, what they were doing here was illegal, actually, right? They were this is an unlawful gathering. Please clear the area. You may have heard the NYPD say that once, right? This is a legal gathering, but this ended up creating facts on the ground that ended up establishing one of the longest lived and largest yeshuvim in Judea and Samaria, in Yesha. And this is all because of Tzvi Yehuda. Tzvi Yehuda is born in Zoymel. He begins editing his father's writings for a long time. Tzvi Yehuda is the sole profiteer of his father's writings, holds it very, very tight. He's rested. He's interned in Hamburg. He returns to Mandate Palestine. He marries Chavaleah Huttner in Warsaw. She passes away. She passes away also after a few years of marriage. No children. Tzvi Yehuda remained a widower for 40 years. Never remarried. So there was no natural successor, no son. There was no, or daughter, that came for him. He's appointed as the Menahel Ruchani of Yeshivat Mer Kazarav. He receives smicha from another chief student of Rav Kook, who we're not going to talk about tonight because it's a totally different story. Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap, who is a mystic, who is quite different, who starts his own yeshiva in Jerusalem. And he begins editing his father's main works, Orot, as well as Orot HaTshuva. In 1952, he's appointed the head of Yeshivat Mer Kazarav, and the Six-Day War happens. And the Six-Day War, he gives the most important speech. Before the Six-Day War, he gives the most important speech of his life, which we're going to do right now. The name of the speech, this is about two months, weeks really, before the outbreak of the Six-Day War. The name of the speech, this would be page number six, I guess. The name of the speech has become known as Mizmor Yutet LeMedinat Yisrael, Psalm 19 for the State of Israel. It is regarded, especially in the settlement movement and the religious Zionist movement writ large, which nowadays has become basically intertwined. It used to not be so before 1967. The religious Zionist movement was something that was a little bit more miguvan, a little bit more varied, a lot more moderate. Chaim Shapira, the head of the National Religious Party in the Israeli parliament, basically they went lockstep with Mapai, which was the forerunner to Labor, who ended up dominating Israeli politics for many, many years before Menachem Begin had the Ma'apecha, and then it became Likud government. But Chaim Shapira basically kept the radicals in the religious Zionist movement, he kept them more moderate. And they focused more on pragmatics and issues of religion and state. After the Six-Day War, it all changes. Some weeks before Six-Day War, Rav Tzvi Yehuda gives a talk, on Yom Ha'atzma'ut, 5 Iyar, 5727, 1967. I'm going to read it in its full. Because it's regarded as prophetic. It's regarded as a prophet getting up to the podium and saying something that that just a few weeks later would become reality, as if he pre-told 19 years ago. Now, if you're going to be shocked by this, because if you think that the religious response to Yom HaAtzmaut would be like this, you couldn't have imagined this kind of response to Yom HaAtzmaut from religious Zionists. So view this as 19 years ago. On the night when the news of the United Nations decision in favor of the resurrection of the State of Israel reached us, when the people streamed into the streets to celebrate and rejoice, I could not go out and join in the jubilation. I sat alone and silent. A burden lay upon me. During those first hours, I could not resign myself to what had been done. What had been done? What was the problem? I could not accept the fact that they have divided my land. He quotes the prophet Joel. Yes, and here he gets, and there's recordings of this, here he gets very strong. Where is our Hebron? Have we forgotten her? Where is our Shechem? Our Yericho? Our Jericho? Where have we forgotten them? What about all the land beyond the Jordan? Each and every clod of earth, every region, hill, valley, every plot of land that is part of the land of Israel, have we the right to give up even one grain of the land of God? On that night, 19 years ago, I sat trembling in every limb of my body, wounded, cut, torn to pieces. I could not rejoice. The next day, the great Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Chalap came to our house. He felt the need to come, and how could he not? We sat together, the two of us, in that small hallowed room in Beit Harav that was his father's home in Jerusalem. Where else, if not there? We sat shocked and silent. Finally, regaining our strength, we said, the two of us as one, this is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. Rather shocking thing to say. A few weeks later, Hebron would be ours, Transjordan would be ours, Yerushalayim would be ours, Yericho would be ours, Har Habayit Be'adenu, the Temple Mount, would be ours. Rav Shlomo Goren, chief rabbi of the Israeli army at the time, and nominally a student, although he had learned in yeshivot before this, Shlomo Goren writes in, if you haven't read his biography, you really should, Magid Koren books, that's the biography of Shlomo Goren. It is a wild book. He goes in on his own, head of the army. A single person goes and gets the keys to Hebron, gets the keys to Marat HaMachpelah, to the cave of the tomb of the patriarchs. A single person goes in, where a Tzvi Huta said becomes truth. But I ask you, what is the central theme over here? The central theme here is dominance of land, is conquering territory, holding on to all territory, and not being satisfied with even the partition plan, with even the fact that Jews are going to go back. It's impartial. Here's Tzvi Huda at the Kotel. That's from Goren, holding the Torah. This is at the Kotel, after the Kotel had been liberated, and he was unable to visit, along with all of the Jewish people, since 1948, since that period. I know it's hot in here, so I'm going to finish soon. Tzvi Huda behind him, you notice another man. Can you see that man with the indented hat? That's the next person we're going to talk about. And that's the other, I think, chief student of Rukuk, who I think envisions an alternate approach. But Tzvi Huda's approach is pragmatic. It's an approach that inspires this speech, inspires that jubilation at Sebastia and the founding of Yishuvim, the people that go out to the next hill to say, this is our land, this is where we need to be, and complete Jewish dominance of the land of Israel, of every clod of earth. That is how the religious Zionist dream is going to be manifested. It's how it's going to be realized. And that is their Zeren. It all comes, that stream of thought is something that is animated, that brings to fore Rav Kook's writings, Rav Tzvi Yehuda's Orot, this, which is a small volume, Orot has inside of it something called Orot HaTchiyah, which is Rav Kook's most potent messianic writings, which is Rav Kook's most potent political writings, in a sense, of what it means for a nation to come back to land. That is what animates this movement. It's what animates the joy at Sebastia. It's what animates the prophetic nature in some people's eyes of Rav Tzvi Yehuda's speech. But the man behind him, over here, with the glasses, so that's our next figure. And that's somebody I think presents, I'm used to a Mac, so I'm gonna, there we go. I don't know if you guys could see this picture of this man. I don't know if you've ever seen a Nazir. A Nazir is somebody that takes a Nazirite vow upon themselves to not touch wine or grape products and to never cut their hair. This is the Nazir, Rabbi David Cohen. Rabbi David Cohen, also known as Harav HaNazir. Harav HaNazir, quick biography, and we might even pack this all in, and this is just to whet your appetite. There is tons of literature on this. Josh Rosenfeld is not going to be the end-all be-all of this discussion. This is just a theory that I have of taking these two figures. I haven't seen it really articulated, but there certainly the idea of Rav Kook's teachings being divided come to the fore in many other debates. Maybe if we have time, I'll touch upon one other quick debate about Rav Kook's writings that I think evinces this kind of split in Rav Kook's legacy. The Nazir, also born in Vilna, Lithuania, he's a prodigy. He
He learns at a young age in the yeshiva of the Chafetz Chaim, the great leader of European Jewry, one of the great leaders of European Jewry, led by the Chafetz Chaim. He's arrested as well. I guess that's like kind of part of the Bible. You need to have been arrested if you were living in Europe at the time. He's also a, I don't want to say tortured, although his writings, his diary, which I've translated sections of, and if you want to read more about the Nazir, you could Google Josh Rosenfeld and the Nazir. There, I have an article about his meeting with Rav Kook in Tablet magazine, and then I also have a post on the Sfarim blog where I translate sections of his biography. The Nazir is a somewhat tortured soul, somebody that doesn't find an intellectual home anywhere. And he goes through this period of time where he's meeting people, he's getting involved with all kinds of different intellectual movements. He enrolls in Freiburg University, studies philosophy. There are gross inaccuracies about his time in that university. I saw a history book, one of these, like, you know, a more traditional history book, I guess, that means you should really, really check the footnotes and the sources. Some stuff might not be true. That says that the Nazir had cast off the yoke of observance when he was there and he was teaching. He was a professor of mathematics at Freiburg University. No such thing ever happened. The Nazir had already taken a Nazirite vow at the time, and when he was studying at Freiburg University, he had a picture of his bride-to-be that he kept on his desk that he would focus on so as not to look at other things. That was the Nazir in university. It's the kind of individual we're talking about. He travels, he hears the Rav Kook. Is Rav Kook's writings had already been known in Europe. He hears Rav Kook is stuck in Switzerland. He travels to St. Gallen. I hope I pronounced that. It might be Gallen, or I have no idea. Right? He travels there, and he meets Rav Kook, and he writes in his diaries, it's a rega machria b'chayai. His entire life is divided into two, before he meets Rav Kook and after he meets Rav Kook. He writes about this experience in the highest of mystical terms. Rav Kook invites him later on to mandate Palestine and begins working on the curriculum for Yeshivat Merkaz Rav. Some of the curriculum is adopted, some not much, because the curriculum is a highly unorthodox curriculum. He has the classics of medieval Jewish philosophy, Sefer HaKuzari, Sefer HaYikarim. He has Kabbalah, mysticism, the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Litzata, the great Italian Kabbalist, playwright, and Jewish thinker, and Musarist. His writings are included. And the study of Tanakh, what would certainly not be your curriculum in a traditional higher institute of traditional Jewish Talmudic scholarship, but this is what the Nazir has. He writes down, we still have his initial curricular notes for what Yeshivat Merkaz Rav would study. I would say that because of the Nazir, in Hester Yeshivas, which I learned in a Hester Yeshiva, it is not unusual to find in afternoon learning sections that people are studying medieval Jewish philosophy. We had a class in Sefer HaKuzari, the Book of the Kuzari. We had a class that is, I think, due to the Nazir's influence. You would not find that if you were to go to a quote-unquote black hat yeshiva, maybe under the desk or something, or outside the confines of yeshiva. That's, I think, the influence of the Nazir. The Nazir begins editing another four-volume work of Kook's writings called Dorot HaKodesh. In it, he doesn't focus on the political, doesn't focus on land. There's sections that deal with Eretz Yisrael in a conceptual sense, but it's Rav Kook's metaphysics. He calls from Rav Kook's notebooks, which are unedited, unorganized, without tables of contents, stream of consciousness, and he calls from it a deep metaphysical tradition, because he comes to Rav Kook, he says, you've taught us so much. You've been an amazing leader, but there's holiness here, there's sanctity, there's something for me to hold on to. And Rav Kook and him have a discussion. He starts to edit it. He finally brings before Rav Kook's death, he brings the galleys for the first edition. And Rav Kook says, it's a wonderful book, but it's not mine. You've done it, right? The kotarot, the titles, the chapter headings, Rav Kook says, this is your own work. But it focuses on Rav Kook's metaphysics, focuses on Rav Kook's philosophy. He also ends up printing his own magnum opus, Kol HaNevuah. The Nazir's whole idea, the Nazir's whole sense of being the land of Israel is one that was intoxicated. There's that word for the third time if you're having a bingo. Intoxicated with godliness. His thought was that you could spend enough time in the land of Israel, because prophecy is only there. You could spend enough time on this holy land, you could push yourself to the point that you could receive something approximating prophecy. That's what you're getting to. And he publishes that book. This is a picture of the Nazir in his house. He's got old volumes he would put the most meticulous footnotes. If you open up a Kol HaNevuah, you'll see footnotes in Latin, in Greek, in Hebrew, in English. Everything is there. André Nayer, the French philosopher, in his book, They Made Their Souls Anew, Ils ont refait leur âme, writes, it was a burning night. This incident happened during the First World War, but the event had no connection with anything that was taking place outside. It was in the innermost depths of his soul that everything happened in one single night for David Cohen.
And the Nazir writes to himself, footsteps pacing here and there, the morning blessings, the Akedah recital. He heard Rav Kook saying the Akedah. That's what turned him. He had initial, their first encounter was something Rav Kook talked to him about Greek philosophy, and he was like, this is the person I've been seeking out. And he was ready to go. He stayed the night. And he goes outside Rav Kook's window. He hears Rav Kook reciting the Akedah, the story of the binding of Isaac, which is part of the morning prayers. If you get to shul early enough, you have time to say it. He hears Rav Kook saying these words, and his whole life changes. He writes, and it's cut off over there. He writes, here's the language over here. And we're going to wrap up. We've got about 5 minutes left. He writes, he says, I listened and I was transformed. I became a new, different person. After these prayers, I hurried to write down that I'd find much more than which I had prayed for. I had found the Rebbe. He's willing to go anywhere for Rav Kook the rest of his life. Here's what he writes in his diaries to give you a sense of the Nazir's relationship with the land of Israel. Now, I want to say parenthetically, the Nazir is also deeply connected to the state of Israel. He would hold study groups in Jewish philosophy with the leaders, political leaders of the state would come to learn with him. Zalman Shazar would learn with the Nazir, one of the presidents of the state of Israel. He writes, here I sealed the covenant between myself and the God of Israel. There are no words to express that which dwells in the innermost reaches of my heart and soul. All the deep philosophical questions have passed over me, and now I feel so, so close to God. A new spirit has descended upon me here, traces of prophecy at the center of the heart of the Jewish people, all connected and intertwined at this place. Where is he when he writes these words? The Kotel. He's at the Kotel when he writes these words. These are his feelings. Who does this sound like? Who does this sound like? It sounds like Rav Kook. Sounds like that poem that we started with, expanses, expanses, nothing can hold me down. In the Hebrew, he talks about his travels in the desert. Nazir would go on these solo journeys into the desert. He even comes close, he writes his diary about coming close to dying on one, which is a good reminder that if you go on a teal in Israel to bring water. Right? He writes about lying down in a talis and tefillin in the desert by Wadi Kelt, outside of Jerusalem, basically in the same area that I was overlooking when I was at Mitzpeh Dani, and waiting to die because he forgot to bring water. He ended up being revived by one of the Bedouin shepherds there. But he writes over here about standing on the hills of Jerusalem, that same intoxicating feeling. So does that feeling lead you to an illegal gathering with your arms outstretched that I'm going to take over another hill and I'm going to settle it? Or does it lead to that feeling I'm looking at those cotton candy sunsets and saying, my Jewish soul is alive. It is exploding in pride and a sense of place. That's what he writes. He writes about feeling ruach, something approximating the divine spirit as he stands in the desert outside of Jerusalem. I would argue, and this is of course an idea that needs to be defined a little bit better. I would argue that the Nazir, Arav Nazir, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda represent two potential ways in which Rav Kook's thought could have been taken. Rav Kook's thought was encompassing. It talked about Jewish philosophy. It talked about Jewish history. It talked about Jewish law. It talked about Jewish sociology. It had all of these things. When you cull from those writings, what is it that you're going to take out of it? Are you going to be like Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who also, to be sure, has plenty of philosophical writings. Rav Tzvi Yehuda was very, very concerned with Jewish-Christian relations also. There's a lot of writing about that as well. These are not monolithic figures by any means. But in this quick sketch that I've given to you, one of these philosophies was taken into what we now understand to be the settlement enterprise, a landed enterprise, something that has Moetzet Yesha. It has its own political bodies. It elects people. It has its own political goals and agenda. And then on the other hand, you have, in the modern state of Israel, you have people like Rafroma, who are so connected to the land, and so beyond law, so beyond concepts of state and of institutions, that they're willing to say things like, I'll meet with Sheikh Yassin, or I will be willing to be a Jewish citizen of a Palestinian state, because it's all about this land. Here's Hanan Porat, student of Ritzvi Yehuda, who later on became a Knesset leader, and had the opportunity to meet him in Yeshivat HaKotel. He was one of the Meshacharei HaKotel, he was a paratrooper in Gdud 55 in Unit 55 that captured the Kotel. This is, anybody know who this is? We're wrapping up here. This is Shlomo Aviner. Shlomo Aviner is one of the most important students of Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook. But to give you a sense of the wrinkles in this, instead of a militant approach during what was the disengagement from Gaza in 2005, when the big question of the day was, should soldiers refuse orders? Shlomo Aviner was famous for writing for somewhat ambivalent point of view and eventually saying that the state of Israel and its institutions might actually come before it. they might actually come above everything else. Land, and control of land is not the end-all be-all. Same is with Rav Yoel ben Nun, the great scholar of Tanakh, one of the science, the forebears of the new Orthodox study of the Bible. Rav Yoel ben Nun, who lives in a settlement, but also wrote scathing letters in 2005 to the religious Zionist community saying what we're willing to dismantle the state of Israel for the sense of holding on to Gaza. It turned out that they happened, I think, to be right in that time, right? They probably should have held on to it. It ended up being a launching pad for what we see now. But this was the major thing. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have people like Rav Shmuel Eliyahu, the chief rabbi of Tzfat, who was a student and learned in Yeshiva Merkaz Rav, who's known, unfortunately, instead of the great Torah scholarship and the great righteousness he's had, he's known sometimes for his incendiary comments that make their way into the American press, evincing a total right-wing nationalist outlook. And then on the other hand, you have, on the same hand, you have Rav Yaakov Ariel, the Rav of Ramat Gan, who's of a similar territory above all else. Right, territory above the state. You might see from people like that, you might see the outgrowth of groups of people nowadays that are willing to go beyond state apparatus to get their goals. And then you have, of course, the Nazir son of Shaar Yashiv Cohen, who founded the Center for Interfaith Understanding and met with Muslim leaders and had interfaith gatherings as he was the chief rabbi of Haifa. All of these people are students of students that represent the power of one individual, the power of Cook's writings, to animate two very different but also somewhat connected. That gathering in Tekoa was also in a settlement, was also in a hill that had been gathered. And also Mitzvah Dani was with people that would show up at that. All of these different streams are students of the same rabbis, students of the same teachings, but I think evince two very different streams in religious Zionism that we're grappling with still to this very day and will continue to grapple with. Hopefully, we'll find a unification of all these ideas, the great universal ideas of Rav Kook, which will be not just a redemption for the Jewish people, but for the world entire. Thank you all so much for learning with me. I'm sorry I went over. I appreciate it very much.